If you're feeling a little cabin feverish, take a little winter road trip to Ottawa, Illinois, a fun, friendly, charming destination with boutique shops, small-town coffee shops, award-winning locally brewed beer, and all kinds of excellent casual and fine dining. Log on to visitottawail.com today.
Today is Wednesday. It's February 26th, 2025 at 2:41 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast. This is the podcast for people who care about Chicago. Share us with your friends, give us a good rating, and listen for me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now doing a Chicago history website powered by Substack called Roseland Chicago 1972.
Marge Halperin here, award-winning journalist, communications consultant, and community activist, doing what I can to challenge authority.
I'm Eric Zorn, publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, former Tribune columnist, who also cares about Chicago.
And cares enough about the Chicago area to describe your backdrop photo that at least the five of us see in this Zoom chat, Eric.
This is the Tiffany Hanyard victory party last night in Dalton.
Looks like fun.
The primary was yesterday.
There is nobody there. Yeah, it's on Tuesday night, and Tiffany went down 88% to 12%. And an election result that frankly surprised me, because I've been watching a lot of the coverage of her tenure in Dalton, and it's been horrifying the way she's spent money and disregarded what the constituents there wanted. But I thought that she was so sure of herself and so Trumpy in that way that voters might just reelect her, that voters tend to have seemed to show a fondness for this kind of attitude on the part of politicians. It looks like strength. And they just clobbered her. They sent her packing. And I was really pleased by that.
Yeah, they clobbered her, but if you were looking at the voter turnout, that was maybe the most depressing thing I saw all night. I think it was something like less than 20% of voters in Dalton even turned out to vote. Maybe it's definitely less than a third. So the ones who did vote, she was absolutely clobbered. But I don't think there was a local race in the country that has much attention as that. And most people couldn't be bothered to vote.
Yeah. The scroll on my TV screen was America's worst mayor. And that's saying a lot, but she has been so, she has so disregarded the will of the people in her district. She has so used the credit cards, the travel opportunities. I'm with you, Eric. I thought, you know, this is a crazy enough world. She could win. Who knows who's going to show up? Evidently, she didn't have a constituency. You know, if she's Trumpian, she doesn't have the MAGA team behind her. She didn't have a MAGA team.
I'm not surprised at the giant turnout against her, because all the meetings that they've been holding have gotten big crowds and some really, really unhappy Dalton voters.
Well, there was a brawl that broke out at the last one, yeah.
Those meetings have been drawing very loud crowds of very interested and very unhappy Dalton voters.
Don't you think, Marge, if you cared about your town... And you do. Anybody that lives, if you're from Joliet or Ottawa or Chicago, I take it personally when people say things about where I live. It must hurt you in some way to be a resident of Dalton and know that your city namesake is the laughingstock of the state.
The low turnout is interesting. It's not the first election in recent memory that was highly impacted by people who did not vote. If that's becoming a trend, staying at home is saying something. What's the phrase? Not deciding is to decide. Maybe people just thought there was enough outrage that their vote was not needed.
Right.
Of course, there are a lot of people who thought their vote was not needed to stop Trump, and they were wrong.
So here's the question for the table here. Do you think that Brandon Johnson is going to get 12% of the vote?
That's the new over-under. That's
in 2027. Now, he's going to be running against more than one opponent, and in fairness. But the recent polling numbers on Brandon Johnson have been just awful. And I wonder if he's even going to bother to run again.
Wow. 79.9% of voters in a recent poll say they disapprove of the job Mayor Johnson is doing. Say 80%. 6.6% hold a favorable view. His net favorability, as Austin likes to say, is negative 73.3%. That is kind of enormous, isn't it, Austin?
I don't think there's been a sitting politician in any elected office in America, definitely in the last 20 years, I don't know about ever, who has had that low of an approval rating or favorable rating from the people in the city.
I know he's unpopular, but a lot of politicians are. Why such a spectacular fall?
Several reasons. I think one is the people he's surrounded himself with. So he won, speaking of low turnout elections and the impact that they have, Marge is right. I mean, there was only a third of people turned out to vote in the mayoral election, and a teeny bit over half of those voted for Mayor Johnson. So I think he came out the gate governing like a majority of Chicagoans had voted for him, when in fact, a very small minority of Chicagoans actually voted for him. And that would have been the case with Paul Vallis too, by the way. So I think he initially went out the gate governing in that way with that kind of bravado. And as he's been kind of boxed in at every turn, he's become more and more insular. He's gone more and more to, I would say, a radical wing of the left in Chicago, which is dominated by his biggest campaign donor, the Chicago Teachers Union. So that's one element of it. And then second, I always want to bring it back to the structural. I think the mayor in Chicago is in some ways built to fail. If you're not thinking about structural reforms to that office, you are going to be boxed in on a bunch of different decisions that you have to make, whether it's, you know, the corporation council stopping the inspector general from going into your gift room, or, you know, having to deal with Chicago public schools. Like, there's just a lot of things that the Chicago mayor is not an easy job structurally, and it's not designed to kind of get the consensus that is needed to govern. So I think he's made tons of personal mistakes, and then there's a structural problem.
Poll results, you see that the percentage of the public that wants to have a moderate mayor, 72% of the respondents in the Harris poll that was taken in December that the Tribune wrote about today, said that 72% want a moderate mayor. And Johnson has really styled himself as a progressive mayor. In tomorrow's Picayune Sentinel, I'm going to have a long list of all the times that Mayor Johnson has cited his mandate, saying, that's why I'm mayor, that's why people elected me, and all the various things that he says that they elected him to do. And Austin is right. He got a very small percentage of the actual total electorate, which is true of in a lot of elections. But he only won by about 4 percentage points over Paul Vallis. It's not a thumping mandate that he got. He got a result that a city that wants a moderate mayor would give you. You know, that half the city was leaning toward Vallis, who is, I think, Republican adjacent, fair to say, and Johnson's very progressive message, and that's the choice they had. And they went narrowly for the progressive mayor. And so Johnson did not seem to realize that. He does not have his finger to the wind of what the public wants to see from him. And these poll results, as we're talking about, are just abysmal. And I don't know how he rights the ship, but he's got to stop asking himself, like, or proclaiming why the people elected him, and asking himself, why don't they like me? How can I turn this around? How can I start getting things done?
I don't think his instinct is to discount it as fake news, popular thing to do among unpopular candidates these days. And I don't think that serves him very well. Your question about whether he'd run again, Eric, is really interesting. I was quick in my head to say, sure he will. And then I thought, yeah, but will he be able to raise money? Well, the real question is, will the CTU back him again? Because they were the source of the funds that really made his campaign possible. I don't think he hasn't done them any favors. They haven't done him any favors. It hasn't been a very productive relationship overall. And it's harmed both entities, I think, pretty seriously. But I do feel, and I think I've said it before in this show, that the prospect of another huge roster of candidates, as we see in this poll, is just demoralizing and bad for the city. I think we need ranked choice voting. I don't think we'll get it in time for this election. I wish we could. But having a crowded field has left us with mediocre candidates repeatedly once the major daily machine died. And I think we're due for another mediocre candidate in a field of 10 or 12 candidates if we don't change our election system.
We will get a runoff, almost certainly.
Well, yeah, but the runoff ends up between, you know, two just random candidates.
Well, Alexi Janulius is not a random candidate, is he?
I'm really liking the cut of Cam Buckner's jib lately.
I love Cam Buckner.
You love Cam Buckner?
I do.
Yeah. I mean, and I'll bet Austin's got some good things to say about Cam Buckner. He just an op-ed in the Tribune at calling for a city charter, which Austin's been banging his shoe on the table about for a long time.
And quoted one Austin Berg in that op-ed, yeah.
And the one thing I saw in that poll, Buckner was sixth, I think, in the or maybe fifth, just after Johnson in that poll. But only two-thirds of the people even know who he is. So he gets some name recognition and gets some traction. I like him as a mayoral candidate in 27. We'll see what happens.
Money is what he didn't have last time.
He's got a lot more recognition now, though, than he did before. And he's constantly churning out those op-eds. I mean, he is clearly trying to get his name out there. And he's been taking some really smart positions where, yes, he was backing Johnson once he got out of the mayoral race himself. And he styles himself as progressive for sure. So he's been backing Johnson, but very carefully. And he's been drawing back where it made sense to do so, right away with the Bears Stadium. He went to the Bears Stadium, big meeting, for instance. But even then he said, you know, I'm here, but I don't necessarily back this. And he has been very smart. I mean, obviously he's running.
Do you think he'd run against Johnson? I'm not sure.
I think he would now. I think he would. I mean, he's obviously a smart guy. He's positioned himself in every possible way to run. And Johnson's popularity polling is so abysmal that it just doesn't make any sense for people to stay out of the race just because they want to be nice. It's politics. You're not going to be nice at that point. I'm curious, Austin, all the numbers are so bad, maybe it doesn't make any difference. But for instance, the polls you IPI commissioned, 14% in January, 14% also in the fall by the same company, M3, that just did basically the same poll for Juan Rangel. And that came up with 6.6%. Now, the Harris poll was done back in December. And that came up with, what, 23%?
23%, yeah.
So you could look at it as December 23%, January 14%, February 6.6%. I don't know. Do you think that's accurate?
Probably ballpark right. I mean, it's not like, I don't think it's an outlier. In polling, you definitely want to chop off like what you're seeing as the high end and chop off the low end. So, saying he's in single digits, I don't think is crazy. I don't think he's not going up. He's not becoming more popular. So I think, and you had this bit, like I kind of mentioned the gift room thing tongue in cheek. The gift room thing was on every single news station.
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing about city council that is different, J.B. Pritzker and Chris Welch and Don Harmon have a big advantage in this. Springfield is only in the news for like 6 weeks in the spring and like 6 weeks in the fall. Yeah. Chicago City Council has stuff going on, has a meeting every month, every single month. And every single month, there's something going crazy in that meeting. And it's a constant negative news cycle for Brandon Johnson because of that, that Springfield doesn't have to deal with. And I would actually say, if I'm Cam Buckner and I'm looking at kind of the shape of the mayoral race, which is going to be really nasty and tough, it's like he's also in really, really high ranking leadership in the Illinois House. He could be Illinois House Speaker one day. So I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that he would run for mayor.
I wouldn't want to be mayor. I totally get why somebody would stick with the safe legislative seat.
You can run for mayor and keep your legislative seat. It's not, if you're an alderman, you can't run for mayor and keep your aldermanic seat because the election's at the same time. He is, I think, behind Johnson, he's the second African-American candidate in that poll. So if you're going for the African-American vote, and the African-American approval ratings for Johnson are not high, and they may be even lower. Who knows what directions those will take? But if you're trying to get the African-American vote, and if he can win that in any kind of substantial way, then that will be a ticket to getting into the runoff, because you don't need that high a percentage of the vote to get into the runoff. I think Johnson got into the runoff last time, but it was roughly 20%, that was a huge field. But I think you're going to have another huge field, too. So
I want you guys to talk about this $830 million bond issuance that the city council did approve today, that the mayor desperately wanted. And he came on our Lisa Dent show this week to talk about it before the final vote. So I have some of his notes about what he said justifying it. But before I get to that, Austin, why don't you start? Just tell us about this bond issuance and what you think about that.
Yeah, I think it's actually a good combination of kind of the structural problem with the personality problem I was talking about. So today, City Council voted 26-23 to approve an $830 million borrowing package. If you listen to the aldermen who voted no, I don't think there was a single one who said, hey, we don't need to borrow to invest in infrastructure. Borrowing is common when you want to invest in infrastructure, because if you fix a road, it's going to be fixed maybe for 15 or 30 years. So why not spread the payment out over 15 to 30 years? This is one of the reasons that we have the ability to borrow as a city, is because of infrastructure. However, those aldermen also said, why is this so backloaded and you're pawning this off on future generations? You're not paying $1 toward the debt for 2 years. So imagine you buy a house. Okay, my mortgage payment terms are going to be, I'm not paying anything for 2 years. I get a free house for 2 years. And then I'm only going to pay the interest for 18 years after that. I'm not touching the principal. What would happen? Well, the cost of your borrowing skyrockets, and that's the case here. It's going to cost $2 billion over the life of the deal. So it's really reckless and irresponsible. And it's exactly the type of stuff that every mayor looks around and says, hey, who screwed all this up when they get into office? So that's what's wrong with it. The structural thing that I thought was really interesting, which speaks to a city charter, and I was glad that Representative Buckner wrote that, is right before the vote on the borrowing, there was an interesting dance that happened in city council. Alderman Riley, who represents the Loop, filed a motion to say, hey, let's delay the vote. Let's delay the vote till May. You need to do a lot more homework on this. There's something hinky going on here. Fix it. And then there was a motion to lay the motion, which means kill the delay. We're not going to do the delay. That goes up for a vote. The vote to lay the motion goes up for a vote, and there's a tie vote. 25 aldermen say, we want to kill the motion to delay. 25 aldermen say, we want to keep the motion to delay and vote on it. State law in Illinois says the tie-breaking vote goes to the person who's presiding over the city council. Chicago's the only big city in the country where the mayor is presiding over the legislature, presiding over the council. And so the mayor did that tie-breaking vote, and then the next vote was on the bond, and they approved it. So the mayor should not be presiding. We need a city charter for balance of powers, for checks and balances. And this borrowing is just another example of that.
Would the equivalent of that be Donald Trump would be the Speaker of the House? Then you wouldn't need Mike Johnson. So what's the point of the legislature if the head of the legislature is the executive, right?
Yep,
although
exactly.
The vice president casts the deciding vote in the Senate in the case of a tie in the Senate. So that is the same thing.
Right, but there's two chambers. We only get one.
That's true. Pat Dowell put an op-ed in the Tribune the day before the vote, 2 days before, the day before. And I thought her rationale for extending the payments out so far into the future was really offensive. She said, why, if these are going to benefit future voters, why shouldn't they share in the pain of paying for it? Why should we pay for everything that is going to benefit future residents? when the fact is that discounts that future residents might need some bond issue of their own, because other things will need capital improvements, other expenses will come up. The point is, if you keep rolling over your current obligations to the future, somebody is just going to collapse under the weight of all of it. And like, it's not going to be us, so we don't care. Is that how they voted? I'm actually siding with Austin on this one.
I don't sound surprised.
The thrust of that question is interesting, because the home mortgage example is somewhat apt, but it's almost like you're buying a house now, and then you're buying another house in 2 years, and you're buying another house two years after that, and you're continuing this kicking the can down the road. It's not like, well, we just have all these things we need done, and we'll get them done, and then we won't have to fix our bridges or our roads, infrastructure, fill potholes. That's all going to be taken care of. No, in what is it, 20 years, when we're going to finally start paying off this, we're going to have these same roads, these same alleys are going to need to be repaired again. And we're going to have to borrow more money. And we're going to have less of it because we owe so much on the bond issue that we took out today. I mean, it just seems it is so infuriatingly short-sighted, of course, you know, you've got 26 votes to pass it, but I wonder how that's going to play when election time comes around. If the voters are actually behind this, if the voters are going to see this and go like, "Wait,
they're not.
If they are, they're sticking my kids with this bill.
They aren't selling it. If it's good for Chicago and good for the citizens and all the wards, they have not done a good job of selling that. I think people go $800,000. I'm going to have to pay $800 million, and it's going to cost me $2 billion. Even I can understand that's probably not a good deal.
Well, we still owe, what is it, $800 million on the $600 million deal for the last Soldier Field renovation?
I was just going to say, yeah.
We that's in the future, and it's hard to get current voters to really lock into the impact of those decisions.
One of the common criticisms that I've seen of this, of kind of like, oh, why is there, this is much ado about nothing. We've always done this. It's like, why is it that Mayor Brandon Johnson is getting criticized, but nobody cared when Rahm did it, and nobody cared when Lightfoot did it. In fact, Walter Burnett on the council floor today said literally, you know, we've always done this, so what's the big deal? Like, that's almost an exact quote. And I'll pull the clip, but it's really kind of wild to hear. There's truth to that. But this mayor is so unpopular that people actually now start caring about these things. And they're like, wait, why is it allowed that city council can take out almost $1 billion in debt and not pay it for 2 years? So it's really disappointing. I mean, it's shocking to me that he could get 26 votes on this while being this unpopular. But again, that goes back to the structural. Like, the mayor is so powerful that even though they're essentially a lame duck, they can get stuff like this done.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping it really lifts people's head to see what's done in other big cities. Why are we so freakish? And not only on a charter, but things like voter approval for tax hikes and new debt. It's not democratic to dump debt on people 30 years from now without even a vote from the people today. Like, a lot of big blue cities have voter approval for debt packages like this, and I think Chicago should have it too.
The way they've structured this specific bond issue is not the way they normally do it, where it is relatively evened out mm-hmm. across the life of the bond issue. Instead, we'll make no payments at all for 2 years and no principal payments at all for 19 years, so that for the last 6 years, when Alderman Bill Conway made a big point that his toddlers are going to be in their 30s and they're going to be paying like $137 million a year for 6 years in a row to pay off the principal of these streetscapes and roads that are allegedly going to get done this year. Obviously, those roads are going to be crumbling at that point in time, and they're still going to be paying for today's bond issue. It's so crazy. By the way, that quote from Burnett, I did find it. It was so nuts that I had to highlight it. He said, "I don't understand why everything we try to do the way it has been done for years is such a big deal." This, after he and the other pro-administration people are saying, "Where were you people when the Skyway got sold? Where were you when the parking meters got sold? You know, you should have voted against those." But now, when we want to do stuff the exact same
way, when we're trying to do a parking meter deal, it's some kind of big problem all of a sudden.
It's crazy.
Yeah, but if we could go back, we wouldn't do the parking meter deal, and we wouldn't have sold the Skyway, you dope.
Well, Alden Beal actually made that point today. He said, you know, I've learned things in the past 25 years. I admit I made mistakes, but I learned things, and thus I want to do better today, and everybody else should join me in doing something better, which, you know, if we're not going to let people grow in their roles, what is the point?
Well, and there was some pushback against Rahm Emanuel when he tried to do stuff like that. It was not particularly loud, but it was certainly, I mean, the Tribune editorial board was always banging on Emanuel for scoop and toss and then some of the other little fiscal tricks that they used to pull. So people have been sounding the alarm about this for a long time, but it's so politically expedient. Brandon Johnson, despite what he thinks, will not be mayor in 20 years. And he is not going to have to be around when the public goes, wait a minute, we don't have any money for anything anymore because we have to pay off the roads that Brandon Johnson wanted to build back in 2025.
One of the reasons I agree with you, Eric, he will not be mayor in 20 years, probably not in the next term, is this entire bond issue is just another good example of how his behavior, as Austin was pointing out earlier, has been part of his problem. He tried to ram this through with no transparency and basically himself and having his supporters question anybody who questioned it, right? That op-ed from Pat Dowell, I thought was incredibly insulting to anybody who read it. It was basically saying, and none of you have the right to question Jill Jaworski because she says this bond issue is fine, when she is the same person who, of course, said that we were not, as a city, going to get our bond rating downgraded after this budget that we just passed. And she was wrong. That was just a few weeks ago. And there is obviously no reason that our aldermen should not be asking questions. But he really tried to ram this through. In fact, at last week's meeting, I think it was Alderman Conway, or it might have been Wagasback, pointed out that when they passed this out of the Finance Committee, they had not been informed about this bond structure where none of the principal was going to be starting to be paid off. But what Pat Dowell did was she super quickly asked for a roll call vote on the amended ordinance in this very quick way where everybody was confused and thought that they were simply doing a roll call vote for what they had just done a voice vote on, which was simply saying, yes, we will accept this change in the ordinance to be voted upon. And so they started doing the roll call vote, and Alderman Beal got up and said, I'm confused. Wait a minute. Are we going to debate this? When do we debate this? And Mayor Johnson, all disingenuous, asked like he doesn't know what he's talking about. Well, we said we're voting on it. You know, what do you expect me to do? What can I do? We're already voting. You can't talk about it. Alderman Beal continued standing. They cut his mic. It was like when the first Mayor Daley was around, they cut his mic. And he just continued standing and yelling, this is shameful. You have to let us talk about this.
Wow.
And then they did this elaborate thing with Johnson saying, this is a courtesy. I'm doing this as a courtesy. And Alderman Dowell will withdraw the roll call vote as a courtesy. He said courtesy like 10 times.
There's the arrogance that accounts for his 6% just approval rating.
Yeah.
The idea that you could possibly ram this through without letting people talk about it it's really sad.
I did want to just mention what Mayor Johnson said at WGN Radio before the vote about the $830 million bond the city wants, or now I guess has. He said that infrastructure and lighting and other, these are just my notes. He said that infrastructure and lighting and other measures are safety issues, and especially at a time when the federal government is being stingy with our tax dollars, investing in people allows for a safer community. And we're down in violent crime again, 25%, he said. We have to spend this money, and this municipal bond gives us the flexibility. We don't have to spend it all in a variety of ways. about the interest. He said the debt obligation the city has is mostly devoted to pensions, thanks to previous administrations. He also said he sees in the next couple of budgets growth as a result of all of this that will help retire the debt. There will be an economic return on this investment. I don't know. I don't know what I just said. That's what he said.
But it ties in with what Dowell was saying in terms of, you know, her op-ed was all over the place. But she had this one section where she says the idea that this bond issuance kicks the can down the road is another falsehood. The opposite is true. And then she goes on to say how we need to take care of our infrastructure right now. Well, you're not kicking the repairs down the road. You're kicking down the road the cost
right.
of making the repairs.
Right.
They're twisting.
That's the can.
Right, that was right. deceitful and like keep your eye on the right can. And then and kind of went on to say, which it sounds like the mayor was saying somewhat to you as well today, that he there she says, well, you know, the cost of a broken of a bridge collapse or a light pole that falls and hits. Wait, do we have bridges that are in danger of collapse? I mean, I'm for ongoing maintenance, but that kind of scare tactic was, I thought, also disingenuous. Hmm. They just didn't make a straight, well, honest case for
it. I think we're all in agreement that you do need to keep up your infrastructure repairs.
Yes.
That you do want your roads paved and your alleys paved and your streetlights working and so on, and your police vehicles in good shape. All those things need to be done. That's definitely true. But again, continuing to take out loans to do these things that are inevitable, right? The city, this is not a surprise. Like, hey, we need to repave the streets. Yeah, we got to do that. And we're going to have to do it in 5 years and 10 years. This is an ongoing expense. We are, in a sense, spending tomorrow's money today, and tomorrow's going to come, and we're going to need money then, too. And this is why this idea of continuing to borrow and borrow and borrow is not really analogous to a homeowner loan or to a home mortgage. That it's like every time, you know, oh, well, the furnace went out, we got to borrow more money. Oh, yeah. The dishwasher broke, we got to borrow more money. Well, at some point, your debt service becomes just burdensome, and you don't have any money, and no one's going to lend you any money, or at least they're not going to lend it to you at any favorable rate. And so it's like a downward cycle. And, you know, I think we're all in agreement about infrastructure.
And it's incredibly disingenuous that all the Johnson people were acting like you people want the bridges to fall down. Alderman Burnett, I think he was actually talking about light poles are going to be falling down. This is going to happen. This is going to happen. When every single person who spoke in opposition specifically said, of course we want to do this maintenance. All we're saying is we need to borrow less. We need to do it smarter. Mm-hmm. We need to do it on a debt schedule that's fairly evened out so we are not paying insane amounts of interest.
A refrain that I would like to see challenged more that Brandon Johnson uses, and he's not unique. Every mayor has done some version of this. He always goes back to investing in people. We invest in people. My mandate is to invest in people. What is the criteria for a bad investment in people? Not all investments are good. I could spend $1 million on lottery tickets and I would be investing in something. I would be investing with the promised return of maybe some winnings on the lottery. It's not good enough to say you're investing in people, because every mayor has said that they're making investments and now we are a junk credit rated city. So you can't justify everything by saying you're investing in people. It's not good enough.
It's not investing in the future.
More from the Rascals after this. If you are feeling a little cabin feverish, take a little winter road trip to Ottawa, Illinois, the fun, friendly, charming destination with the boutique stores and the small town coffee shops, award-winning locally brewed beer, all kinds of excellent casual and fine dining. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 private rooms, hotels, private rentals, B&Bs. Start making memories in Ottawa. The middle of everywhere. Log on to visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. By the way, when you go there, you can also find out about the annual Morel Mushroom Hunt that's going on. You can sign up for that now. But now, let's go back to the Mincing Rascals. Illinois has a medical aid in dying bill It's sponsored by Senator Linda Holmes of Aurora. It's Senate Bill number 9, and it would give terminally ill persons in Illinois the option of ending their lives. A doctor would not do it. The person would have to consume or administer the drug themselves. It will take 2 doctors to sign off on a diagnosis that the person has less than 6 months to live. 10 other states have a version of this. Canada has a version of this. If all you know about it is that brief description, are you for it, or are there enough potential abuses of this that you're not for it?
Listen, there's a lot of details that would be pertinent about how it would be implemented. But the whole concept is a painful one to think about people who are so in such pain and such agony that they're done. It's hard for us as relatively healthy younger people to understand that point of view, but I think you have to respect it and give people an option to control the most important decision in their lives. My in-laws used to joke they had Dr. Kevorkian on retainer. Luckily, we didn't need to call him, and they had a more smoother exit than they were envisioning. But it's a frightening thing to think about, to lose control of your own body and decisions at such a key moment. So I'm sympathetic to some version of this.
I listened to you speak with Linda Holmes. She sounds completely reasonable. Linda Holmes watched both of her parents die from cancer, and they were very, very painful and long deaths. And frankly, I don't know how you get to be even in your 50s without having relatives who you have seen go through these things and sat with your dying relatives. I know I have. I tell my kids, I joke about it a little bit. I say to them, hey, you know what? When my time comes, either hand me a gun or I will drive off a cliff like Thelma and Louise. That's not for me. I'm not doing that. And they're like, oh, don't talk about it. Like, you have to know, because that's the deal. That's how I feel about it.
Yeah.
You have to have 2 doctors say that you only have 6 months to live. I think there's a 5-day waiting period before you can get the prescription for the medicine, which you have to administer yourself. There's a lot of great guardrails.
She also pointed out, as you know, that in the instances where states do have this and then the person has got to the finish line and now they can administer the drug themselves, only 37% of the time they do. But you have agency. You're in control. So if you don't want to, you don't have to. So nobody's forcing anybody to do anything they don't want to do.
But then I do look at Canada, and it is kind of a cautionary tale up there. And they did experience a slippery slope. It's not completely unwarranted that once you begin to normalize the idea of assisted death, that the slippery slope is easier for society to go down. So like in Canada, they went back in 5 years and they adjusted it so that you did not have to have a terminal diagnosis. You could just be, having a chronic pain or illness that was not going to kill you.
They allow that now.
Yes, that became legalized there in 2021.
Well, that doesn't sound like the slippery slope. That sounds like liberalizing it to make it even easier for people to use this law.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a slippery slope if you go into it thinking only for people who only have 6 months to live, and then you change it to people who have no terminal diagnosis.
Okay,
at all.
Okay, so it sounds like you don't support, or that's the criticism of it, that now we're expanding the reach of this law. My dad has more than once said, I'm done. My dad is not going to die within 6 months according to any diagnosis. But if he doesn't want to live his unfortunate existence, losing his hearing, losing his sight, his mobility, if he doesn't want to do that anymore, why are we asking him to do that any longer? I would liberalize it even more so.
I completely get it. But I really am concerned when I look at Canada.
Who would it hurt?
The number of people who choose it has increased quite a lot.
Who cares? It's their life. Who cares?
1 in 5 people now.
Who cares?
They have already actually put in law that people who are merely depressed, and I don't want to downplay the seriousness of being depressed, but mental illness is now a reason. Now, that's been postponed, because there was a lot of controversy, so they postponed it. So I just want to repeat that number, though. 1 in 20 people now die in Canada of assisted death.
Wow, that's amazing.
And so there is some concern.
I don't even know that that's cautionary, though, Kate. I mean, maybe that's good. Maybe 1 in 20 people should be allowed to do it that way.
Well, maybe. Well,
I mean, I think the thing you do want to make sure that you don't assist people who are simply going through a period of depression to kill themselves. And you also don't want there to be any in way that families would put pressure on somebody to take their lives when they actually have some quality of life left. Right. And they're like, well, I should do this because my family kind of wants me to kill myself and they can have the inheritance or whatever. You do want safeguards like that. On the other hand, I think one of the early patients of Dr. Kevorkian's was a woman, maybe his first patient, I don't remember, but was a woman who had been diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. And having seen up close in my family the ravages of Alzheimer's and how awful that is, I certainly don't want to live like that myself. I don't want to put my family through that. And if I were diagnosed with that and I got to a certain point, I would want to be able to say, look, I'm not going to die in 6 months. And that's the bad part. I don't want to live another 10 years like this. And I might well live another 10 years like this. I mean, I do think that at the end of the day, I myself would want that autonomy. And so if I want that autonomy for myself, why would I not want it for others?
Yeah, I think the strongest argument is, John, you pointed this out, I think it's the bodily autonomy argument. It's my body, my choice. I think that totally makes sense. I think the strongest argument against it and where people have a gut reaction is something to the effect of, when there's someone in your life, I guess this is going to be so morbid, and I don't know if I even mean to say it this way, but if someone wants to die, many people do commit suicide. Why aren't they doing that? The difference, the tension between they're not doing that and I want a doctor to do it is where I think this gets brought on like a really personal level for people. And I think that actually means it's more about the slippery slope argument to me is actually more about the doctor who has, you know, pledged a Hippocratic oath that says do no harm or injustice to my patients. And it's worrisome, how can you guarantee you're not doing harm by giving someone the tools to kill themselves? So that is where I think people get uneasy. And I am heartened by the guardrails that are on this. I also agree that culture sometimes is downstream from law. And if this is a more acceptable thing, then perhaps the law could change down the road. So I'm very torn.
One thing, though, to shoot yourself, to take a gun. And it's another thing, especially if you're captive in a medical environment, you know, to want to do something in a more medical manner. I want to add one other concern that we haven't discussed. And these results from Canada showed a lot of examples. I haven't seen statistics, but a lot of examples of people who went for medically assisted death because they didn't have access to adequate medical care. They didn't have the social circle or support of people that they need to continue their life with whatever disability or pain they have. And access to medical care is a critical issue in our country today. We seem to be debating in D.C. taking away some access to people who need it, whether it's Medicaid or Medicare. And if we don't first prioritize affordable health care for all, then this discussion is a little bit in a vacuum.
That's an interesting point, Marge, but I think either way, you're still holding those people hostage. So until we decide to have better health care in America, you're going to have to suffer. And I don't think that's going to happen in maybe these people's lifetimes, to say nothing of the people who we would all agree legitimately should have access to this. There's no other hope for them. I to me, it is astounding that you would pass judgment on how other people choose to live or die when it has zero zero impact on you. It's of zero consequence to you. And if it's unfortunate that person passed away and they could have gotten better health care, or they might have felt better down the road, or maybe they were going to live past 6 months, maybe they were going to live several more years. I heard from somebody who said the guy was told he had 6 months to live and he's golfing 3 years later. I will allow for all of that, but in the meantime, there are plenty of people who really could use it, and we're telling them, you know, we're still not comfortable with it, so you're just going to have to suffer until we feel more comfortable about it.
I'm with you on that. I spoke in favor of agency first, but I don't want a bill like this to be a substitute for adequate access to affordable health care.
I can see that point, for sure. I wanted to talk about J.B. Pritzker, as we were just talking about something that the state might talk about a little bit. I have the big J.B. Pritzker note here, Marge. Why does it say J.B. Pritzker on my notes?
Because he's been so darn interesting lately.
Well, so there is a bill before the legislature to J.B. wants to ban. I don't know if there's a bill or it was just a pronouncement by him.
There's a bill introduced, I think, in both houses.
That would say that
two different bills.
That schools, that students cannot have smartphones or cell phones in the classroom, in the school at all. The news clip we posted for our listeners was, do you support JB on this, or you like the idea of no phones in the schools, but you want to leave it up to the schools and the teachers, or you don't like it at all. It should be up to the parents and students. They get to have the phones any way they want. I'm on the top of that. I say I like JB's idea. Just make it easy for the schools and say you can't. It's the law.
I'm on the bottom of that list. There's a reason why we have local school councils that are combined governance by parents, community, and teachers. And I think that's who should be making the decisions at each school. If I were a parent of a school child right now, I'd want them to have a phone. I know that school shootings are a small number nationally, but they're random. And I would want my children to be able to contact me if there was a crisis in their school of that kind or some other kind of threat. But I don't want them on the phone all the time. My husband, a retired teacher, has seen high school classes where every kid walks in a lab class, and the first thing they do is plug in their charger, and then they just sit on their phones. Well, that's the teacher's fault. I think the teacher needs to hold attention, and I think if the school council, a joint decision is made by parents and teachers and leadership in the school, then it needs to be enforced so that kids can learn and not be staring at their phones hour after hour. I don't think they should be using their phones in the classroom, but as a parent, I think I would want my children to have it.
The two bills that have been introduced are pretty similar, would only ban the phones during instructional periods.
Sure.
And basically, say, you school districts have to come up with your policies on how you're going to do this. So if I'm correct, that means they have the choice between whether the kids are allowed to keep their phones, but they must be put away in their backpack or whatever, or if they want to do something that schools do, and I've seen examples listed both here in Chicago and in other school districts where the kids all give their phones to an official cell phone room, I guess, in the morning, and they're locked up for the day. I know if it was my school, I would say the kids do not need their phones, period. If we understand how harmful the cell phone time is for the kids' social development, then as bad as it is during instructional periods, it's just as bad when they walk out of that classroom. They're not interacting with each other like normal people anymore. Everything I've read is that teachers see that the kids suddenly can talk to each other again and look at the teachers and have conversations. They don't like it at first, but then they get used to it.
Well, Marge,
and all of a sudden it can become normal again.
And Marge brought up the idea that if there was a school shooting, she wanted to be able to communicate with her child. How would that safeguard the child? It might make you feel a little bit better, but weighing against all of the ill that Kate is pointing out with phones in the classroom, you want, though, that lifeline to your child. But what good is it going to do you or the kid if there is a school shooting, Marge? How does the phone help them?
You hear all these 911 calls that kids make cowering under their desks. And in some cases, the first alert to police has come from a child with a phone in the classroom. It's a horrible thing to contemplate, and I know it doesn't happen every day, but it happens way too often in this country if it happens once, and I feel that's a safety thing. But I'm not saying kids should be able to use their phones during school day. I don't think they should.
But they will.
But I think that's where the school needs to
enforce. I think if they have it, they will. I do agree with you, Marge. I think it should be probably decided at the school level.
Both me and Austin have said very little about this. I will just say that I can see a situation where you could prohibit the use of cell phones except for emergencies in the school, maybe have a designated room you can go to if you need to make a call in the middle of the day because you want to check on your ailing mother or something like that. But that if your phone is visible in school, then the school can confiscate it for a week. And that would horrify every person I know to have their phone taken away from them for a week. I don't think it would pass legal muster right now, but yeah. If you could pass a law that would do that so that students could have their phones in the extremely unlikely event of a school shooting, and it is still extremely unlikely that you would have the phone there, you could make the call, but other than in a complete emergency, your phone cannot be visible. And maybe that would be the solution, that give the schools the right to confiscate the phones for up to a week. And that would, I bet that would keep the phones in the backpacks.
Teachers have a really good nuanced understanding of this. And I think broadly what many teachers think is essentially it's a Pandora's box. Like if the phones are in the school, they're going to be in the class. And there is like this utopia where it's like, oh, well, they're not going to be out like during the class. But if they're in the school, like they're going to be in the class, they're going to be on them all the time. And I get the safety argument for sure. And then my immediate next thought is like, well, for most of human history in our schooling, we did not have these devices. And was there horrible abuses that happened probably because they were not there? Yes. But also like maybe learning was better and maybe that's just the cost of it. I totally agree with decentralizing the decision school by school basis, at the very least, so we can get some good data. Like we should get great data in Illinois about how this works, which schools are doing better, and see if you can attribute it to that. And then you can talk about maybe a statewide case.
Oh, yeah. Something. Maybe scores go up in some of the schools.
Austin, your wife is a school teacher. What does she think about this?
I don't know. I think the last time I asked about this, I'm vaguely remembering her opinion, but don't quote her on it.
Wow.
But I think it's kind of like you're in for a penny, in for a pound on phones in schools. And I will say, like the Yonder bags, they're called Yonder. I think it's the company that does them, where you lock it and then you can magnet them open. Potentially good idea. Just do that at the front of the school. And then when you leave school, ba-boom, you get your phone. Easy.
I do have a friend who's a child psychologist in CPS. So I asked her what she thought about this. She said there is just no end to the problems that they have with phones. You might not think of it, she said, but just kids making videos of things going on in classrooms, themselves in classrooms, is a big problem. It's like akin to having a really, really bad case of ADHD for kids to have their phones.
I can relate to that, though, myself.
You know. I know.
Exactly.
We want the kids to exercise the discipline none of us have.
We know we don't have the discipline. So how would we think that little kids or teenagers are going to have that?
Do as we say, not as we do. Yes.
I mean, there's classroom management here that teachers are supposed to be trained in and be able to manage their classroom.
Jeff Bezos sent a note to the Washington Post staff members today announcing the resignation of the editorial page editor. David Shipley is this guy's name, and he quit over the new dictate from the paper's owner, which, according to the staff email, is about a change coming to our opinion pages, quote unquote. He said, "We are going to be writing every day at the Washington Post in support of and defense of two pillars, personal liberties and free markets. Viewpoints opposing those pillars will be left to be published by others." He said, "I am of America and for America and proud to be so. Freedom is ethical. It minimizes coercion and drives prosperity." He said at the memo's end, "I am confident that free markets and personal liberties are right for America, and I also believe these viewpoints are underserved in the current market of ideas." Eric, what was your reaction to this? I'm disappointed. Maybe I shouldn't be surprised. These are the same people that pulled an editorial that would have their endorsement of Kamala Harris. But what's your reaction to that, Eric?
Well, first of all, I don't think that the free market personal liberties viewpoint or the right wing viewpoint or the conservative viewpoint or libertarian viewpoint is underserved in the market. There's lots of outlets. There's Fox News, Newsmax. There's a lot of places that are advancing these point of views. Many popular podcasts are doing it. So it's like not like you can't find these points of view in other places. And he's right that if you go and go around the internet, you can find all his various points of view. I do look to newspaper opinion sections for a variety of views. I see things in the Tribune and the Sun-Times op-ed sections that infuriate me at times, but I'm a better person for having read them. I'm a more informed person. I am better able to understand the points of view that differ from my own, and I think that's what a responsible mainstream media outlet does. Turning it into a propaganda arm for his point of view instead of a general opinion section, it's a my opinion section for Jeff Bezos. And it's a huge mistake. I certainly understand why the editor of the editorial page left. I wouldn't be surprised to see more columnists leave. You had Jennifer Rubin left the Washington Post just recently, and she started Substack, is doing very well.
She's the cartoonist you're talking about?
No. That she's a columnist. I don't know how the cartoonist is doing, but I can imagine a lot of columnists walking out. Eugene Robinson, what is he going to write? He's a hard lefty columnist who is on MSNBC all the time. What's he going to all of a sudden change his views? I don't understand how he can possibly fit into, or Jonathan Capehart, the columnists there, Philip Bump. How are they going to comport with this edict? I think it's a big mistake. I think they're going to lose a lot more readers from it. I think Amazon's going to lose some customers over it. Very disappointing, dismaying, very, very dark day for American journalism.
I don't even understand what it means, because if it's going to be pro-freedom and pro-personal liberties, that would mean a variety of viewpoints. That is the whole point of free speech. So I don't really understand what his columnists would bring to him under that regime that would suddenly...
Personal liberties.
I know that the Washington Post was notoriously woke for a long time and that they've been going through turmoil about that. But I thought the idea was that they were, in fact, going to become more heterodox, which... Okay, good. Heterodox is good. But I wouldn't think any of their columnists had been advocating for communist dictatorship, which is the only thing I can think of, really, that would be against his new rule.
You mean free markets?
It's against free markets. What does that mean?
I think it means less regulation.
I think it's if his edict was to the editorials and say, our editorials are going to be focused on this. Okay, that's fine. Most publications have an editorial point of view, and they stick to it. But he's talking about all the opinion content as I'm reading this, and that's how it's being read in the
our opinion pages. Yeah,
our opinion pages, and that is vastly different from what the Tribune does, Sun-Times does, any of these pages. That an opinion section is something that if you don't get riled up by something you read in an opinion section, it's not doing its job. If it's always just comforting you, if it's always just a silo, it's kind of why I find MSNBC just about as boring as I find Fox News. I don't really want to hear the same point of view, like a circle of people sitting around the table all agreeing with one another. I don't necessarily think that's
But what do you think, Eric, he is talking about? So I think I know what he means by free markets. But he said that we are going to be writing every day in support of and defense of two pillars, personal liberties. So what does that mean? What is he asking the opinion pages to endorse? I'm not baiting you guys here. I don't know what he's talking about.
Well, I think it would say, like, okay, if the Washington Post is going to weigh in on hate speech, they're going to be on the side of more free speech. You know, more speech is better, right? Not censorship. Or maybe they might be, I don't know, pro Second Amendment or something. Maybe that's another personal liberty. I have no idea what Jeff Bezos' vision is on that. In my opinion, it reads to me like I am the owner of the paper, and the editorial tone of the paper is going to reflect my political views. whatever those are. My political views broadly are, I like personal liberties and I like free markets. And I don't know if it's anything really more complex than that, is how I read it.
But how does that square with DEI stuff or LGBTQ issues, for instance? Those are personal liberties. Those are expressions by individual persons, and the idea was to embrace those. Oh, no, the conservative element in this country doesn't want to. So I guess this doesn't fall under that umbrella, Austin, would you say?
It's the difference between something like, are you pro interracial marriage? Like, yes, of course, I'm pro personal liberty. Of course, that's great. Are you pro a law that says every single publicly traded company has to have XYZ quotas filled on their board? That might be called DEI, but I also don't think that's necessarily like pro diversity in it, as everyone would see it, right? It's actually kind of a mandate. It would be an infringement of someone's personal liberty to choose who they would like to serve on their board, whether it's it's all female board or an all Hispanic board or an all male, like that's someone's personal liberty. So I think that's probably the line there.
I feel like the difference is personal liberty is the opposite of social good, public good. This is because sometimes your personal liberty infringes on other people's rights. And in this country, we've worked really hard to balance those needs. But if your personal liberty is that you can carry a gun and intimidate people around you in public, then you get to do that. Well, my personal liberty is offended by that because I don't feel safe when you do that. There's a pro and a con. If your personal liberty involves transgender transition, but it offends my sense of who the genders are, then you're not allowed to do it. That's how it's being interpreted now. I think the bottom line interpretation of what he's done here is earn himself a seat in the White House press pool.
Yeah, really. Well, and maybe the point That's isn't sure. then these two pillars as much as it is that he's not going to tolerate whatever the things are that he were going to stake out. The point is, he's not going to allow on his opinion pages any dissenting views on that.
The point is whether or not your op-ed section is going to have a good diversity of views that help people shape what they think by seeing some debate.
I want to just underscore the idea that it helps you understand what you think to see what other people think. It sharpens your point of view. It may change it may not, but at least you understand. And it also, I think, serves the idea of democracy when you understand that someone who you understand the point of view of someone who differs from you, but you see that maybe they're not coming from a wicked place, but they're just coming from they have a different concept of it. So you can then see some common ground and feel like you can work together rather than just hate each other. And that's part of democracy too, which is like knowing that we're all in this together in a lot of ways, and we're going to have different views and we're going to vote differently, but that in many ways we have similar goals.
I wonder how long and hard he's thought about this. It's at a time when the administration is taking so much heat for so many things and Trump's numbers are going down. And I wonder if this is in response to that. It's like everybody's ganging up on my guy, and therefore I'm going to say that we're only going to represent one side of the issue to try and level the playing field.
I didn't think it was the end of the world when they said that they would not do editorial endorsements, even though we obviously would know that they were going to endorse Kamala Harris when they decided not to do endorsements. I don't have a big problem really with that. And I didn't have a problem with them not running that cartoon. The editorial editor, David Shipley, who just resigned rather than head this new bizarro world op-ed section that is not an op-ed section, he's the one who did not run that editorial cartoon, which was, it showed Jeff Bezos kissing the feet of a Trump statue or something.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He wasn't alone. There were other tech guys.
Right, and all the other tech guys were there, too. I thought it was a lousy cartoon. It added nothing to the debate visually or in its opinion. But this is crazy. This is just nuts.
I thought that letter was so offensive. It could have been written by Musk. The arrogance of it, the cruelty of it. He said that he talked to Shipley and told him this new direction and then asked him if he wanted to stay under these circumstances. And he said the answers are only hell yes or no. I was so offended by that. To treat an employee that way is the tone of what we're hearing out of Washington right now. And fundamentally, the idea of a free marketplace not getting enough attention, look at how DOGE is rampantly cutting all of the federal regulations in order to allow a free marketplace. And I guess my individual liberties don't extend to being safe from contaminated food or bird flu or dangerous highways that were supposed to be repaired under the IRA or all these other things. So this definition of personal liberties is what I said earlier. It's my personal liberties and no one else's can infringe on mine is sort of his point of view. And fundamentally, I think legacy media is systematically destroying its own legacy, and the media landscape is changing. And there are more ways to get more balanced news than those sources that we grew up with and thought were the end-all be-all. There's the Tangle Substack that now gives a very balanced view of pros and cons and all the key issues in the news. And there are many others who will have, as Eric said, the right-wing view or the left-wing view, but there are moderate Substacks and other kind of publications. And we're going to have to, as people who grew up with legacy media, have to learn how to sort through and find the kind of information that does for us what Eric has so eloquently said media has always done in the past.
Yeah. I've done that for a long time, so I don't have a problem with it. But what I do see as a problem going forward is that all the journalists whose work I follow on their individual websites or Substacks, who I know to trust from their track records, they have track records because they came up through legacy media, through the New York Times or wherever. So, you know, they had a training ground. They had, you know, some way to learn their craft and for you to see their work before, you know, you had to decide whether or not just to trust them as an individual. And I don't know how that's going to be replaced.
Okay, that's going to wrap it up. That's Austin Berg. That's Kate Pleiss. That's Marge and Eric. I'm John Williams. Producer Pete and Ben Anderson helped put this thing together. We'll drop another podcast on you next week. All right, guys. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. That was fun.
All right. Bye, you guys.
Stay well. Stay warm.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.